So let us continue. And now I want to go back again to the Four Noble Truths. So that's what we're actually doing on page 6. So we've just been looking at the various ways of why old age, why death, why being separated from the pleasing, etc., why all of these things are suffering, why they are problematic, and also quite a bit about what to do about this, how to use this in practice to help us on the path, etc., etc. So once you kind of pull the details out of this, actually it's quite interesting, isn't it? When you just read it like that, it seems kind of a bit bare, but once you kind of pull out the details of this and look at it in more detail, it's actually quite interesting here. And the very last part of the First Noble Truth is, in brief, the five aggregates subject to clinging are suffering here. And I thought it might be worthwhile to talk a little bit about that, because I know from experience that people often find it quite hard to get their head around this idea of aggregates. What are these khandhas? What do they actually mean in practice? I often get asked, as a monk, and it's quite a strange thing, I often get asked, what are these khandhas? I say, well, khandhas, you know, they are form, feeling, perception. Yeah, but what are they? I just told you. No, but I mean, really, what are they? And there's a point to that, yeah? A point is that it's kind of abstract. Okay, you got these five things, but exactly what do they mean? What do they mean in lived experience? How do we relate to these things in a way that is useful so it actually makes a difference to us in our life? And that is what I think is so important about this. Everything really on the Buddhist path should be practical. It should be how we relate to it, how we use it in a way that actually it has an effect on our lives rather than being some theoretical thing or whatever. And the first question is, well, why does the Buddha talk about five khandhas? What is it about these five things? And the reason is that, remember, the purpose of the Buddha's teaching in the end is to kind of to have insight and see reality as it actually is. And a very important part of that is to see through the illusion of self, yeah, the sense of I, which is always there. And to be able to help us see through that illusion, what the Buddha does, he shows us the main areas where that illusion tends to take root. And that is what the five khandhas are about. This is where the sense of self tends to kind of take root, somewhere in these five khandhas. And that is why they are called the five aggregates. I like to call it maybe the five factors of personality, or the five aspects of personality is what I like to call it. Five aspects of personality that are subject to attachment, to upadana. Upadana means to take up. Yeah, you take these things up. And the reason they are subject to attachment is because this is where we see the sense of self, and this is what the sense of self holds on to. Yeah, that's why they're called upadana khanda. So it kind of lies in the almost the wording of the thing, panchupadana khanda. Upadana is the idea of attachment. It implies that the sense of self is kind of holding on to these things. So that is why these things are taught by the Buddha, so as to help us uncover the illusion of the self. So they're very, for that reason, very profound things. Yeah, very, very deep, and they can take us a long way on the path if we approach them in the right way. So these five aspects of personality subject to attachment or subject to taking up, they are, let's just go through them very briefly, they are form, yeah, rupa is the first one. And what does form mean? And sometimes it means similar to the physical body. Yeah, physical body is form. But actually it means form in a much broader sense than that. It means form in the sense of, if you imagine your vision, your visual perception, you see forms, yeah? Air conditioned units, sound absorption panels, yeah? Chairs up there, curtains. We see all the things, and all of these things are forms. They're like shapes, yeah? That is what is the meaning of form. And our body also, in a sense, is a shape, yeah? It's part of that. So this is what is meant by form. Any kind of impression of the physical world, if you like, is what form is about. And this is interesting because it means that form is not limited to kind of ordinary forms that we see as human beings. Let's say that you get reborn in the Devaloka, it might be very different. And there might still be forms there. Or even when you go into a deep state of samadhi, there may be forms there. You may see things. And those things that you see there, those forms are part of the idea of the rupa kanda. So it's much more than just the ordinary thing. So when we die, for example, we don't leave all the form behind, because some of the forms are in the mind. They are mental images. So some of the form actually exists also after we die. The form isn't left completely behind. So the Buddhist idea of mind and body is much more interwoven than kind of the usual idea of mind and body, that they're two completely separate things. But in Buddhism, they're not completely separate things. They're very interwoven with each other. Even when you die, what you do is that you come out of this physical body, but you have another physical body, which is a more fine material body. And that also is a form. Yeah. So form actually goes with you. It is quite complex. And only when you go very high to the immaterial attainments or whatever, is it possible to leave form entirely behind. But before that, it is always there. So it's quite a broad category of phenomena, rupa. It certainly does not just mean the body. And of course, we take that as a sense of self. You look at yourself in the mirror, you think, that's me. You don't think it's someone else, that's for sure. You think it's you. So that's me in the mirror. Okay, whoa. So when you see yourself, this is how we attach to that form to some extent. Then second one is Vedana. And Vedana you're probably very familiar with already. It's quite an easy one to understand. Feeling in English means the extent to which any experience has a positive or negative or neutral impact on your mind. Is it positive? Is it good for you? Do you feel? Are you happy about this one? Is it a good feeling? Or is it a bad feeling or a neutral feeling? Three types of feelings. So that's the feelings. Feelings are, of course, very significant, very important in life. Feelings are what gives our life value. Without feelings, there is no value. Feeling is what helps us to decide on anything in the world, whether we should pursue it or not. If it feels good, we tend to pursue it. If it feels bad, we tend to avoid it. So feeling is what gives value to the world. And this is one of the reasons why a computer or an artificial intelligence can never really have values, because they can't feel the world. It doesn't matter how smart that artificial intelligence is, it can never actually feel anything. And because it lacks feeling, it lacks values. You hear the kind of horror stories, you go to the movies, and they talk about, how machines kind of take over the world, and they start killing human beings, that kind of stuff, as if they have a mind of their own. Machines are going to take over the world, we're going to run everything, these human beings are a nuisance, let's get rid of those human beings, and we will take over the world. But machines can't do that sort of thing, because they don't have any values in their own right. They don't feel that taking over the world is good or bad. For them, it's nothing. They don't have feelings. So machines are just the extension of the feelings of other human beings, those who program them. That's what machines really are. But they are value, don't have any values. So because of that, they can't really do that kind of stuff. So I think a lot of the fear that people have of artificial intelligence, I think it's misguided, personally. I think it's a lack of understanding the difference between machines and humans. The difference is quite significant. Anyway, that's a bit of a sidetrack here. Then there is perception. What is perception? And perception is our ability to recognize the world. That's what perception is. So when you're able to understand what I say, hopefully some of it anyway, and hopefully I am reasonably clear, but I'm not so sure about that either. But the perception is your ability. If you can understand me, that means that your perception is that you're perceiving what is going on. You're recognizing what I'm saying. Or your ability just to, this room, your ability to see this room properly, that's perception. There's a room, people, floor, tables, all of these things. Coffee, one of the most important perceptions, perception of coffee. And so we have all these perceptions which helps us to make sense of the world. We cannot make sense of the world without that. And it goes a long way. It's not just the immediate perception, but also deeper perceptions. Yeah, perceptions of value, of, you know, who are these people? Are they a friend or are they an enemy? Yeah, this is kind of a part of that perception. Perception about politics, about religion, about philosophy. All of us have these kind of perceptions in many different layers. And all of this is what helps us to make sense of things, enable us to understand what it's about. And so perception is very vast. It's a very, very important category of the five khandhas. And that too we hold on to, we attach to some extent. Yeah, we perceive certain things in a certain way. You perceive someone as a friend, and one day they don't want to talk to you anymore. Feels terrible, yeah, because you had one perception, your perception was challenged. When you don't want to talk to anymore, you feel bad about that. Or you have an enemy, you are a sworn enemy, and one day they're friendly to you. You think, whoa, what happened? And your perception changes, and actually you think, well, that's a wonderful thing, and then you become friends with them. Yeah, so our perceptions too get challenged because of our attachment to them. And for that reason, oh, you are happy, and then one day you get depressed, and you feel terrible, you feel depressed about being depressed, because you had this idea, perception of yourself as a happy person. That too is a part of, can be a problematic. You perceive yourself as young, and then one day you look at yourself in the mirror, you realize, actually, I'm not young anymore. I'm middle-aged, now I'm old, okay. And that too is problematic. So perception, we attach to these things. Then there is volition. That's the fourth one, sankhara. Sankhara literally means the will. And the will is just this feeling that we are agents in the world. Yeah, we have power to affect the world. We can do things. And that agency, the sense of being in charge, of being able to do things, that is what sankhara is all about in the five khandhas. And this is a very strong identification with the will. Yeah, it's a very important part of what we feel like as human beings. We are the doers. A lot of people identify with a doer. If you are a businessman or businesswoman, you do things, yeah, you make things happen, and you identify with that because this is such an important part of your life. So you identify with a doer, and that is why, that is part of the khandhas. You may wonder, how can you reduce some of that identity with the doer? Why is that the problem? One of the ways to do that is to recognize in your meditation practice, when you become peaceful, there's less doing going on, yeah? There's less thinking, less activity going on. So when the doer subsides, when the doer is reduced, you feel better. Yeah, you feel more at peace, you feel more at ease, you feel more relaxed. And then you realize that the willpower, the doing, is actually a problem. It is actually causing you difficulties rather than being your friend. Actually, it is the exact opposite. So this is very often how you relate to these things. You relate to them through your experience, and you start to understand why they are problematic. So that is the will, that is the fourth khandha. A very important part of the sense of self is in the will. And the last one is consciousness. It's awareness. Yeah, the ability to be aware of anything at all. The fact that you are able to know anything, or be aware of anything, that's consciousness, vijnana. And this is perhaps the most basic thing of all that we take to be ourself, that we are aware. Even in the deepest states of meditation, awareness is still present, and that still serves as the basis for your identity, even in the deepest states of meditation. The knowing, you know what's going on, you are aware, you have the ability to be here. So that is in brief what the five khandhas are about. And all of these places is where we tend to place our sense of self. It is among these five khandhas somewhere. And this is why they are such an important base thing in the Buddhist teachings. Because this is where we look if we want to overcome the sense of self. So how do we actually overcome this? How do we actually deal with these five khandhas in practice? How do we actually, how do we see them as impermanent, for example? How do we understand them as suffering? This is kind of the point here, yeah? The five khandhas, in brief, the five khandhas are suffering. How do we do that? And the way, one of the best ways of doing that is to do this through your meditation practice, but not by following what I would call traditional vipassana meditation practices, but by following the instructions of the Buddha. And the instructions of the Buddha for how to do this, you find this in places like the Anapanasati Sutta, the mindfulness of breathing here. And what you see in the mindfulness of breathing sutta is, actually we're going to talk about this later on when we do the meditation afterwards, I think, was not actually here. What you see in that sutta is that the Buddha looks at the mindfulness of breathing through a number of stages, 16 stages of mindfulness of breathing, yeah? And it starts off with a long breath, a short breath, calming the breath, feeling the full body of the breath, and all of these kind of things. Then it goes through feeling the breath, various ways of feeling the breath, piti, with sukha, with it has all the feeling, then it has all the various formations of the mental things, yeah? So various stages that you go through, deeper and deeper experiences of the breath meditation. Deeper and deeper, the breath becomes fainter and fainter, you feel more and more happiness, things are gradually becoming simpler and simpler as you go through this process, yeah? And then, when you come to the very end of the first 12 steps, that is where you enter a jhana state, vimochayang chittang, liberating the mind. And then after that, you have the last four of the 16 steps, and they are anicca nupassi, viraga nupassi, Nirodha Nupassi and Patanissaka Nupassi, and these are all contemplations that you do after you have gone through the first 12, or at least some of the first 12 steps. And Anicca Nupassi is contemplation of impermanence, yeah? Yeah, which is very similar to what we're talking about now, the five aggregates being dukkha. Yeah, contemplating the impermanence of these things. Viraga Nupassa is the fading away. You contemplate in the fading away. Fading away of what? Of that whole process. I've just been mentioning very briefly of the breath becoming more and more refined. Nirodha Nupassi, yeah? Nirodha is cessation. You're contemplating the ending of things as they end through this process. Patinissaka Nupassi, the giving up, the relinquishment of these things, this whole process. So, that process you have been looking at, the breath, becoming more and more refined. And as you do that, what you see is that things start to come to an end. Yeah, things start to disappear during that process. What is it that disappears? The body disappears. The five senses start to become less and less. All you have is the breath after a while. Everything else is gone. Certain feelings start to disappear because you can't feel the body anymore, and you have mental feelings of pity and joy instead. Then the joy starts to die down, and you get other kinds of happiness coming up. Perceptions start to change, yeah? These are the five khandhas, right? Perceptions start to change because initially you have a very coarse perception of the breath. It becomes more and more refined until the breath disappears completely. So perception is changing. Certain perceptions are fading away. Certain perceptions are ceasing altogether. The will, something is happening to the will as well. What is happening with the will is that as you go deeper and deeper in meditation, the will becomes less and less prominent until the mind is completely stable and the will is completely gone. Yeah. Consciousness itself also is actually becoming less and less here, because as you go through this process, as the senses shut down, the consciousness related to certain senses disappear. So consciousness itself is disappearing here. So what you are seeing here, you're actually quite literally seeing the five khandhas. You're seeing them gradually being impermanent, fading away, and ultimately ceasing completely. That is what you're seeing. The process of simply watching the breath, all you have to do is watch the breath, yeah? And as you go deeper and deeper, you observe, you can see directly how the five khandhas are changing here, and how they are disappearing completely here. That is all there is to it. It's very simple, yeah? It's not very mysterious at all. It's a very natural thing. You just go through this beautiful process, and you have, afterwards, when you come out of that process, you come out of your meditation, whether it's a jhana, or maybe not a full jhana, whatever it is, you look back, and you see the impermanence of the five khandhas directly. And of course, when you see that impermanence, what you also see at the same time, you see, well, when those khandhas disappear, how do you feel? You feel better. Yeah, perception is, certain perceptions are disappearing, certain feelings are gone, the body is completely gone, the will is completely gone, a large part of the khandhas have disappeared, and you feel so much better for it. That is how you know, this is one way of knowing, part of the knowledge that the khandhas are dukkha. You can see it directly, it's just in your face, it is so obvious when these things happen. That is why when you enter a jhana state, you actually have very profound insight, because a large, very large portion of the khandhas has disappeared, and you feel absolute bliss as a consequence. So you see impermanence, you see suffering. What about non-self? Well, non-self is also very similar, because non-self means that if something is yourself, it means it's something that you control, something which is always there, something which is present. But when things disappear completely and they're gone, and you are happier without it, it's very obvious that couldn't be yourself. Because actually, I'm glad that disappeared, yeah? I don't want to have anything to do with that. So it is no longer part of your self-perception. So you see also non-self. Yeah, so all you have to do is such a beautiful thing. All you have to do is watch the breath. Take the breath meditation really seriously. Keep on practicing that, taking to deeper and deeper levels. And as you do that, and you look back upon the process, you see the impermanence of all this. You see the dukkha, you see the non-self. It is staring you in the face. You can't avoid the insights anymore. The insights just come to you. That's why the deeper your meditation is, the more insight you will have. Sammata vipassana, always going together. Deeper the calm, the sammata, I should translate this, sammata means calm, the deeper the calm, the better is your clarity of seeing, the more things you can see, because you see precisely this process of stopping, the process of things fading away. So this is what the five khandhas are all about, and this is why they are important, this is how you contemplate them, and this is really what it's all about. And again, bring it back to reality. It is not so hard to understand what is going on here and how it all works. So the Buddha says here, this is kind of interesting, the five khandhas are suffering. Yeah, the whole caboodle, all of them, all five, everything, it's all suffering here. And this is the Dhamma in brief. Sankhitena Panchaparama Khanda Dukkha. What does that actually mean in the final sense? I've been talking a little bit about now, about how what it means. You five khandhas cease, yeah? But you haven't seen them cease fully yet. What you have to do is you have to extrapolate from what you know already. The five khandhas have ceased a little bit, you feel a lot better. If the five khandhas were to end completely, whoa, that would be really it. That would be the highest happiness. You can start to extrapolate, start to understand that, because you see a little bit of disappearance, a little bit of happiness. Middle amount of disappearance, a middle amount of happiness. Complete disappearance, supreme happiness. The five khandhas are dukkha. Yeah? Get rid of the five khandhas and you achieve the highest happiness. That is what it's all about. Dukkha has come to an end. It's hard to understand this as a theoretical thing, but once you start to look at it in this way, I think it kind of, at least it makes a little bit of sense. Of course, it only really makes full sense once you see these things for yourself, but at least probably enough for you to get a handle on what's going on. So, that is the first noble truth. Is it good or bad? It's good, it's quite good, isn't it? Yeah? When people tell you, first noble truth, dukkha, yeah, suffering. You think, what? That doesn't sound anything interesting at all, yeah? But now you've been just talking about dukkha for hours and hours and hours, and actually it's quite interesting here. Once you kind of look at it in a deeper way, it's actually quite fascinating to see what's in there in this very simple first noble truth. So, there you are. So now we can go to the second noble truth. Hopefully it won't take as long as the first noble truth, because then we have to extend the retreat by a couple of weeks. Are you No, I promise you, the first one is much more time consuming, because it is, we have to go in. These next ones are going to happen very quickly, actually, so it's not a problem. Okay, so let's see what the Buddha has to say about this. Now this, bhikkhus, is the noble truth of the origin of suffering here. It is this craving which leads to renewed existence. accompanied by delight and lust, seeking delight here and there. That is craving for sensual pleasure, craving for existence, craving for extermination. This is the second noble truth. And you will notice here that it is not just any craving, but it is the particular craving that leads to renewed existence. Ponobhavika craving. Ponobhavika means going on to a renewed existence in the future. So in other words, a craving that leads to rebirth. That is the problem here. There are also desires that do not lead on to rebirth. The desire to practice the path, the desire to make an end of craving and all these kind of things. There are good desires, and they are not part of this. So here you can see there, right there, the main three desires are craving for sensual pleasures, the craving for existence, and the craving for extermination. But it is particularly the craving that leads to renewed existence. And you can now start to see another aspect of this. We have just been saying that the five khandhas are dukkha. Well, if the five khandhas are dukkha, how is it that the five khandhas keep on going again and again from life to life? What is the? How does that happen? Well, it happens through the process of rebirth, yeah? That's how they are kept going. So if you stop rebirth, that means that the khandhas will also stop, and so suffering will stop. So rebirth craving, because it creates rebirth, it actually creates suffering. The five khandhas, rebirth, suffering, these are all the same word pretty much, and it perpetuates itself in this way. So when you stop rebirth, that is why rebirth is the problem. That is how you stop suffering. And craving is the driving mechanism that drives rebirth on into the future, etc. Why does craving drive you on into the future? Because craving, in a sense, is always about the future, yeah? Always about some kind of future state. There's always something else that you want. You're always projecting yourself into something different. That is why craving really drives the process on. Even after you die, it keeps on after you go. Accompanied by delight and lust, rag nandiraga, delight and desire, if you like. Yeah, so this is just another way of saying craving. It's all about delighting in things and desiring stuff. Seeking delight here and there. Tatra tatra binandini. Here and there, the idea is that there is no end to craving. There is not, that doesn't come, okay, you have tried everything in the world, so you start yawning, you tried everything, you know, the world has become boring. No, there's always something more, always something else that kind of, gets hold of your fancy, and then you move on to something else. There's no end to these things. So this is what the idea of tatra tatra binandini, moving on and on and on, never finding any final satisfaction there. That is the craving for sensual pleasures, the craving for existence, the craving for extermination. And this is one of the main reasons why the craving for sensual pleasures is so problematic, because the craving for sensual pleasures is one of the things that binds us more than anything else to the wheel of existence. As long as we have that craving for sensual pleasures, we cannot keep on moving into the future again and again and again, always seeking for new things and never finding that satisfaction and contentment and completion I was talking about before. You can't find that through craving. Instead, it just drives you forward from life to life. And this is the main problem of sensual pleasures. And if we can overcome the sensual craving, that we actually have overcome the main problem, the main hindrance that stops us from overcoming suffering altogether. It sounds strange, because sensual pleasure, well, actually, it's quite pleasurable. You're just enjoying ourselves, what's the big deal? But actually, this is the main thing that ties us to the wheel of existence. Then you have the craving for existence. This is a very deep-seated craving. We want to exist. We want to kind of carry on. We want to go from life to life. very deep-seated desire in human beings that we want to. We don't want to die. If somebody says, "I'm going to kill you," we say, "No, thanks. I'd rather continue to exist." Yeah. If you're an arahant, then they say, "You want to kill me? Oh yeah, whatever. You know, it's really up to you. Yeah, I wouldn't recommend it because you're going to make some bad karma for yourself. But you know, if you must, you know, that's kind of the arahant approach." Yeah. But most people don't think like that. We think, "No, okay, you know, not today. Thank you very much. Let me become an arahant first." So this is very deep-seated. But the whole point, of course, is that if you see that the five khandhas are all dukkha, you're not afraid of existence coming to an end, because existence really is those five khandhas. You're actually quite happy for existence to come to an end, because you realize it is a pain in the backside, this thing we call existence. And then the last thing is the craving for extermination. It's the weird thing that if we crave the ending of existence, that too is a problem. Because craving for extermination, craving is always a projection into the future. It's always about the future desired state. And because it is a projection into the future, that craving too creates renewed existence, precisely because it is a craving. Yeah, so it's kind of strange. You crave to be exterminated. But sorry, that's like if you commit suicide, yeah? And you commit suicide, you come out the other side and you're still there. And sometimes, yeah, it's kind of sad. Yeah, you had enough of life. You don't really want to go on anymore. And so you think, yeah, I'm going to make an end of it, shoot myself. Yeah, and then you die and then you come back again. And some of those problems will still be there. So it is not really an answer from the Buddhist point of view. So instead of exterminating of that, we cease. Instead of ceasing is the Buddhist idea. Yeah, you just cease and gradually cease. And that is what happens instead on the Buddhist path. So this is in brief what the Second Noble Truth is about. So let us have a look at very briefly at another sutta, which talks about this as well, a little bit. And this is found on page 18, just following on from where we were before. And this is an expansion on the idea of craving being the cause of suffering. Yeah, and what is interesting about this is that dependent origination is that expansion. Dependent origination, as we saw before, is really an explanation for why suffering arises in the world. What, bhikkhus, is the noble truth of the origin of suffering? Yeah, we've just been looking at it now. And then you have the whole sequence of dependent origination. From delusion, you have all these activities. We start acting in the world. Because of those activities, the intentional activities, our consciousness is always kind of established at a certain level. Because our consciousness is established at a certain level, we experience the world in that way. That's nama-rupa, name and form. With the nama-rupa, with that experience, comes the six sense bases. Six sense bases means that we contact the world through those six sense bases. When we contact the world through those six senses, we have feeling that correspond to that contact. Yeah, you like the color, so you think, okay, nice color, you feel good about it. Then you crave according to the feelings you have. Because you crave, you have the upadana, you take things up, you do things in the world to help you satisfy your cravings. The things that we take up in the world decide what kind of existence we have, how we live our life. Yeah, we live our life according to a number of things that we kind of do in our lives, the things we take up. Then that existence, again, depending on how we live that existence, depending on what kind of karma we make, again, we lift up or down our consciousness and get reborn accordingly. And when we are reborn, then of course that birth leads to old age, death, and the whole mass of suffering comes about because of that. And this is what this says. With birth as condition, old age, death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, dejection, and anguish comes to be. Such is the origin of this whole mass of suffering. This is called the noble truth of the origin of suffering. So, why is there two different definitions of the origin of suffering? In the Second Noble Truth, it says craving is the origin of suffering. Here it says ignorance or delusion or avidya is the origin of suffering. So is the Buddha contradicting himself? Did he kind of change his mind that, oh, actually I got it wrong, I better change my mind? Probably not, yeah. What is going on here is that the idea of dependent origination is just an expansion of the other one. So the other one says that craving is the cause of suffering. We have seen how that works by craving, kind of projecting, keeping the five aggregates going, the five khandhas going into the future. It keeps suffering going through that. But dependent origination is really just an expansion on that. And instead of stopping at craving, it takes it back further by asking, what is the cause of craving? And it goes back all the way to ignorance, to avidya, to delusion, being the ultimate cause of suffering in our lives. And so there's two ultimate causes here of suffering. One is craving, the other one being avidya or delusion. How do they relate to each other? And the way they relate to each other is that craving can only exist when there is delusion. When there is delusion, when we misunderstand the nature of the world, that is why we crave. Yeah, we crave to get all of these things, when actually we should realize that when craving stops, we feel far more contented. So that is the problem. Delusion, it would actually what drives the craving. So when we say that craving is the source of dukkha, we actually, it is implied that delusion is already there. Delusion is already part of that. Because if delusion wasn't there, we wouldn't be craving in the first place. So delusion and tanha kind of coming together. And one of the reasons why it is nice to kind of take it back, all the way back to the beginning, to delusion, is because craving, often we can't do so much about that. Okay, we are already craving. You can restrain yourself a little bit, but there isn't really any clear-cut solution for how to end craving, yeah? Craving is almost like a natural part of being a human being. So to understand how to overcome craving, this is where dependent origination comes in so handy. To understand that, we take it back all the way back to avidya. And avidya is something we can do something about, according to the Buddha, because avidya, delusion, can be overturned by practicing the Noble Eightfold Path. We can see things according to reality, yeah? And that seeing of things according to reality is what the overturning of delusion is all about. Through samadhi, through stillness, through all these practices, these things can be overcome. So that is the second noble truth for you, how it works out, how it kind of is explained in a little bit more detail. Does that make sense to everyone? Yeah. Okay. Yeah, please, 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 yeah.
Jen, about the five aggregates, the sense of self.
Yeah.
I recall in 2015, the global conference in Perth.
Yeah.
There was this group of practitioners. One of them is the colorblind artist. Is it
the cyborgs?
The cyborg artist.
Yeah.
Is it avidya that they mess with nature? Or am I looking at it that the intention is wrong? I'm not sure. Because I would be afraid to mess with nature. But it's good that we can overcome our shortcomings by using science and technology.
Yeah.
Like colorblind, but can use the ear to see colors and so on.
Yeah, exactly. Is it bad to kind of mess with nature, and do we kind of... And I don't think it's either bad or good. I don't think it's either one. You know, it really depends on why we do it and how we do it. It can be bad if you are deluded about what you're doing, and you are kind of, I suppose, you are kind of putting too much value into those things and making this what is really important in your life. But sometimes it can be handy to know color, you know, to be able to communicate and whatever. So I don't think it is a problem, really, myself. It's like if you go deaf, for example, it can be handy to have a hearing aid so you can hear something, yeah? There's nothing wrong with that. So I think it really depends much more on how you use those things. And if you use them in a broader context, maybe to help you out, and maybe even use them, you know, to for Dhamma purposes, I don't think there is any real issue there. I think it's perfectly okay. But sometimes I think the problem with some of these people, this becomes their entire life, yeah? Entire life revolves around these things. And then it becomes a bit shallow. It doesn't really have any depth to it. It's not going to help you overcome suffering, yeah? If you think it's going to help you overcome suffering, then of course, it is not going to do that, that's for sure. But if it is just a bit of, you know, messing around and playing around and kind of helping you out a little bit, and you don't take it too seriously, I don't think it's a problem. I think it's okay. It was quite cool. There was this fellow. He was Spanish, a Spanish guy, and he had implanted this thing on his head. Yeah, and it was this kind of microphone or something like that. It kind of stuck out like this. Yeah, on his head, and it implanted it, so it actually was fused to his skull. Yeah, fused to his skull, and then it kind of came out like this eye or whatever in her, because he was colorblind, so he couldn't see anything here. So this was like a camera, so whenever he looked somewhere, this camera would kind of see the color for him, and it would transfer it into an impulse into his skull, so the skull would vibrate in a certain way, and then he could feel the vibration, and in this way, he could know what the color was. This is real, yeah. He was there. This was a global conference that we had in Perth in 2015. And this fellow was, you can actually probably look him up on the internet. You can see him on the internet. And he was a certified cyborg. That's what they called him, a certified cyborg. He could hear colors quite literally through the vibrations in his skull. He was really far out, but he was actually a very nice guy. I spoke to him afterwards. He was a really nice fellow, you know. So friendly and so nice. I was really, and so kind of positive and good. So I was there. He was actually very, I was very surprised with this fellow. So sometimes you meet people like that who are really out of the ordinary, to say the least. And do wild things. Okay, so let's have a quick look at the Third Noble Truth as well, which is the opposite of the one we just saw. Back to page 6. Now, this bhikkhu is the Noble Truth of the cessation of suffering. It is the remainderless fading away and cessation of that very craving. The giving up, the relinquishing of it, the freedom from it, the non-reliance on it. And that same craving refers back to the craving in the Second Noble Truth, yeah? And when the remainderless fading away and cessation, when it disappears completely, only then do you actually have the cessation of suffering as a consequence. Absolute final craving. No craving for existence. No craving for sensual pleasures. And not even for to be exterminated. So when all that is completely gone, then the five khandhas cannot replicate themselves into the future. Words here are just ways of talking about the giving up of that craving. You give it up. Mutichaga annalaya, mutichaga patinissaga, that's the relinquishing it, but patinissaga means kind of the absolute giving up. Chaga is like usually a word used for generosity in Buddhism. It's the giving of things, yeah, you give it all up. Freedom from it, and this of course is because if craving is the slave driver, then when the craving stops, you're actually liberated from the craving, because the craving is a problem if it drives you around. And the non-reliance on it is the analaya. Analaya is alaya, is like the Himalaya, the Himalaya mountains, yeah? Hima is snow, alaya is to kind of rest. So it's where the snow rests, is the Himalaya mountains. That's the meaning. Same word as here. These are all Indian languages. They all kind of match together very nicely. So analaya is the non-resting, yeah, the non-resting of craving is completely gone. It is not established in your mind anymore. Yeah. Yes, we're in.
Could these four words, Chaga, Padinisaga, Muti, and Analaya, mean the same thing?
Do they mean the same thing? Can they mean the same thing? I don't know if they actually are synonyms. I think they are more like different angles in which to understand the same thing here. And the idea is that, you know, when you give up something, there are different kind of results from that. There's different angles in which to understand that giving up. One is the giving up in a sense of generosity, but it's not really generosity if you give up suffering. But anyway, that's what it looks like. And there's a relinquishing, and then there's that you are liberated from it. But all of these things are part of the idea of giving up, but there are different angles from which to view the giving up. Is that what you mean? Or?
Yeah, because you say giving up of suffering. If you give up suffering, you also give up happiness.
Aha. Uh-huh. Okay. Yeah.
Giving up, so
yeah.
Because sometimes in the suttas, a string of words, they actually mean the same. Mean.
It is very common. Yes, I think in this case they are very close to related to each other, but not actually synonymous, I think, in this particular case.
Thank
yeah.
You.
But it's interesting. If you give up suffering, you give up happiness. That's an important point. Yeah. Because these things go together. So people say, I want to have happiness, but not. I don't want to have suffering, but I want to have happiness. But this is kind of one of the things that is very difficult to understand about the Buddha's teachings, that actually you're not really giving up happiness as such, you're just going to a higher level of happiness. And to be able to see that, you look at the four jhanas, for example, and with the four jhanas, you are going from one happiness higher than the next one. So the first jhana, already the happiness is so high, you kind of don't know what to do, you feel completely blown away. I can't take this. Well, too much happiness. And then you realize, actually, there's even more happiness called the second jhana. And then there's even more happiness called the third jhana. And at the third jhana, you reach the peak of happiness that is possible to reach in samsaric existence. Yeah. And the Buddha says, yeah, now you've finally become happy. Yeah, because you kind of finally become happy. It sounds like the Buddha is understated. Yeah, he says, okay, now you've reached happiness. Actually, it is the highest happiness possible in samsara. And then the interesting thing happens. Yeah, all happiness ceases. All happiness comes to an end. You go into the fourth jhana, and when all happiness comes to an end, what happens? You're even more happy. What? How is that possible? Yeah, if you feel a feeling of happiness, it is better. The feeling of equanimity is actually a preferable feeling to the feeling of happiness. That's what the Buddha is saying. Equanimity is better than happiness. Even when you have the most intense bliss that you have ever experienced for many hours going on, that is inferior to the experience of equanimity. Equanimity is the experience of the four jhana. It's better. And that's why when you're giving up happiness, you're not actually giving up anything. You're getting something better instead. This is kind of the weird thing about the Buddhist path. And this is why it is so profound. Yeah, it's so incredibly profound. How can you even get your head around these things? The only way to get your head around these things is actually going through the experiences. And on the way, as you go through that, whoa, so much good stuff. Yeah, everything is just so great. And it becomes even greater. And then even greater. And even greater. And where is this going to end? Yeah. And where it's going to end is kind of, it's the greatest of all. So that is the idea of the cessation of suffering on the Buddhist path. So let's go back to the page we just looked at before, which was page 18, which then shows this in context again of dependent cessation. The cessation, everything coming to an end, yeah? What is the noble truth of the cessation of suffering here? With the remainderless fading away and cessation of avidya. You can see here exactly the same wording as for the remainderless fading away of craving. Here it is delusion instead. When delusion comes to an end, when you see things according to reality, all activities stop. You stop searching for happiness in that world. You stop searching for looking for happiness outside. You realize that the ending of all activities, when you become completely peaceful, that actually is the real happiness. So you don't do any activities anymore. Because you don't do any activities, you're not creating any karma anymore. Your consciousness is no longer affected. Your consciousness is only affected as long as you do intentional activities. Yeah, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that. That is when your consciousness is affected, because you feel that you are either doing good or bad. But now you have gone beyond that. You're not doing anything anymore. So your consciousness is no longer stationed anywhere, because it doesn't have any. It's not affected by your actions, by your activities. And because your consciousness doesn't have any station, when you die, there is nowhere. That consciousness doesn't have a level that can continue. There is no level for the consciousness. That lack of level means that consciousness, instead of continuing in a certain realm, it stops right there. And that is why this is the ending of the five khandhas. There's another way of looking at this. And that is, you can look at it from the viewpoint of the ending of craving. So when craving stops, what happens? Well, when you don't crave anymore, you don't need any strategies for taking things up, for attaching to things. So upadana must stop as a consequence of craving stopping. Because you don't take any things up. You don't exist anymore in any ordinary sense. Yeah, you don't have any house anymore. You don't really have a religion. You don't take all of these things up because you need to fulfill your craving. You let everything go. You don't exist in any ordinary sense. If you look into the mind of an arahant, they're not fantasizing about things. They're not thinking about this and that. Their mind is basically just empty. Because their mind is empty, there is no existence in that mind. When the mind doesn't exist, again, the consciousness doesn't have any level. There is no level there. There's no kind of, it doesn't belong to any particular realm anymore. Because all of these realms require that consciousness is holding on to some of these realms. When there is no realm to which consciousness belongs, there is no rebirth as a consequence. Rebirth comes to a stop. And this is how all of these things cease as a consequence. So this is the cessation of things. This is very profound. And this is what you see, yeah, when you get a deep insight onto the Buddhist path. So if you don't, I'm not sure if I fully understand exactly all the details of this myself, because it is very profound. But it gives you a rough idea of what is happening when you look at it that way. Yeah. And this is the cessation, how the cessation of suffering comes about as a consequence of the ending of delusion. When delusion is ended completely, suffering also stops. Why? Because you don't get reborn again into the future. So that is the second noble truth. We have one noble truth left to go. The fourth one. But I think I will stop there again, because I think we have been already doing probably too much already for today. So I will stop there, and then we can kind of look forward to the wonderful fourth noble truth tomorrow instead. Yes, please, Wayin. Yeah.
Ajahn Brahm has always said that vijnana is six types.
Yeah.
So we should also think of consciousness.
Yes, yeah, that's exactly right. And that was what I touched on that very briefly before, because I said that, you know, when you meditate, you start to see consciousness disappearing, yeah? So the senses disappear, so certain parts of consciousness also disappearing as you do that. So that is exactly right. Six kinds of consciousness. So this is one of the ways of understanding the impermanence of consciousness itself. So the reason why we feel continuity, because you may wonder, well, if there are six types of consciousness, yeah, I consciousness, E consciousness, how come it feels like I am always here? How come it feels like there is continuity there? And the reason is because the mind consciousness, which is the sixth type, you have the five senses, eyes, nose, tongue, ear, and feelings. The sixth type is the mind consciousness. And every time you have one of the other senses operates, the mind consciousness comes right behind it and takes the sense consciousness as its object. Yeah, so for example, at night, if you have a dream, it's as if you are seeing. Yeah, when you dream, it's as if you are seeing things, but you're not actually seeing anything. It's just the mind that kind of recreates the vision. So the mind is capable of taking all the other senses as its object. You can hear in the mind, you can see in the mind, you can smell, all these things you can do in the mind's consciousness. So that is why there's a sense of continuity there, because the mind consciousness lies behind it all the time and creates this feeling of continuity inside of us. Okay, any other question? Maybe we can wait a little bit and we can continue with the Q&As in a minute. I don't want to go any further now because it's only a couple of minutes left. Any last questions on this? Are you all okay here? Yeah? Okay. So let's have another short break, half an hour's break, and then do a little bit more meditation afterwards, and then finish off with some questions and answers. All those really hard questions that you kind of really don't, you're almost afraid of asking me, write them down, yeah? And put anonymous on the bottom. So nobody can type it out, so nobody can recognize your handwriting, yeah? That kind of stuff. Okay, we'll see you again in half an hour.